Hi, my name is Jill. I'm a compulsive overeater and food addict. I consider myself a recovered compulsive overeater, recovered but not cured. I will be a compulsive overeater, and I consider myself a food addict until the day I die. That will never change. And thanks to this program, I'm okay with that. Finally, I'm not railing at the universe. First, let me qualify. You know I live in New Jersey. This is the furthest I've ever been for an OA meeting. I came into program I became abstinent January 2nd, 2008, before my first meeting. It's a long story, I'll explain that. I started my diet, which I thought it was a diet. It was my food plan, and it was a sugar and flour-free food plan, before I came to my first meeting. And I mourned that food. I had my last meals, and I mourned over that food. And then I walked into my first OA meeting, not knowing it was a HOW meeting. And it was perfect. That was the food plan I had started. And that was January 4th, 2008. So I have 6 years and a day shy of 6 years and 5 months of abstinence. You'll also hear in my story, probably that part tomorrow, that I lost my last 50 pounds in these rooms in that first year in 2008, but my top weight was 360 pounds. And that was in 2004. I lost a lot of that weight before hitting OA through craziness and desperation, and it was really ugly. But in case you don't believe me, because most people look at me and I can see it in their face, they really don't believe it. These are some pictures of me at my, I'm not connected to anything, am I? Some pictures of me at my full weight. The one picture you'll see, I was, you know, such a dieter. That was my before picture. I took it one way, I took it the other way, so people would see, because I was determined I was going to lose weight. But that was before program. That was just a crazy diet. So, I came all the way across the country, and first of all, I am blown away by how beautiful it is here. It is just breathtaking. So that alone is an honor. But I came to share my story of transformation, because I have been truly transformed by the 12 steps in this program. I consider my life a miracle, and it's not my miracle. I humbly tell you that this miracle was a gift from my higher power, and it was a grace, and that grace is freely given to anybody. And I just feel so honored to be able to be here and tell you how that happened. So, first of all, let me explain how I was with food. Tonight I'm pretty much just going to talk about my history with food, not my life story. I might tell the details of my life tomorrow morning. We'll see how it goes. But as early as I can remember, I am sure that I felt differently about food than other people. I didn't know. I thought I was the only one. But food was always so vitally important to me from the time I was tiny and little, and all I did was desperately want more food. And I tried to figure out ways I could get more food, and I dreamed about more food. At the same time, it's really important to say that from as far back as I can remember, I felt different, period. I felt separate, I felt other than, I felt not a part of. I don't know which came first, it really doesn't matter. They both grew together. This need to have more food and this feeling other than and not a part of anything in this world or anybody grew steadily. I can really identify with Bill's story in the Big Book because my disease was so progressive. As a child, I was chubby. Of course, you know, woe is me. I thought I was fat. I thought I was so totally different. I look at the pictures, I was chubby. But I was chubby enough that the nurse had me in a special lunchtime program to learn how to eat. Boy, did that disease grow. By the time I was a teenager, I was dieting hard. I had to diet hard. And I look at the pictures, and I still thought I was fat, but I wasn't. But this becomes the craziness of the disease. And it started that yo-yo. Take off the weight, keep it off for about 10 hours, start putting it back on. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
I don't think I ever hit maintenance when I hit a goal weight for more than 24 hours, seriously. It just progressed. I had my first child. I was at an extremely high weight for me then, and I spent a lot of money and went to a diet center. I lost 50 pounds in 12 weeks. It was intense. I hated every minute of it. I hated my food. I hated myself. I suffered. I couldn't wait to get to maintenance. I got to maintenance. I was at 125 pounds on my frame, which was pretty good. And they told me, oh, you know, you can have an extra 2 ounces of fat-free cheese every day. Yay! And I went home, and what did I do? I ate an entire box of cookies. An entire box. And I got back to the center the next day. I had to weigh in every day at this crazy place. Every day. And I went back to the counselor and I said, you have to help me. It's a very rare moment of honesty for me to tell anybody what I had done. I said, you have to help me. After all this hard work, I ate a whole box of cookies. And she said, well, get on the scale. All right, I went and got on the scale. She said, you didn't gain an ounce. You're fine. And I knew I was done. I was done. I put on that 50 pounds in less than the 12 weeks it took me to take it off. And the rest is history. I dieted. I got bigger. I couldn't take as much off. I put it back on. Whenever I was dieting, my family will tell you I was a crazy person. The big book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent. That was me dieting. Restless, irritable, and discontent. What I did not know I had, it took me 47 years to figure out that I had certain foods that once I started eating, it was outside of my control to stop eating them. I have an allergic reaction to sugar, to not all flour. No, wait a second. To flour, not to wheat. Anything ground processed into a flour, yet I can have wheat. I also have an addiction to peanuts, other foods, high fats, high fatty foods, and the perfect combo, all three together, sugar, flour, fat, the perfect trifecta. I became a secret eater. A binge eater, able to eat huge, enormous quantities. What I had was a few moments of glory, and then after that, a totally mechanical, mindless, hand-to-mouth. Nothing going on here. I became an eating machine. And of course I did that in secret, because I wasn't going to let anybody see that. The minute I was done, I wanted more. It was never enough. How does the expression go? One bite was too many, 1,000 was never enough. I know for a fact that I am one bite away from that. I say I am recovered, not cured. I know if I pick up my substances, I will be back there. I am fully convinced to my innermost self that I am a food addict and a compulsive overeater. Not only that, I got that coming into program. I knew when I read the book that I read that I had an abnormal reaction to substances. It took me a while longer to figure out the mental obsession. The mental obsession that once I put down, when I was dieting, some of those diets, look, they took out those substances. And I felt a peace. I felt my body go. But what made me break my diet? If it was good enough to just put it down and not pick it up, I would have been fine. But I had a mental obsession. A mental obsession that constantly took me back. And then I would eat, and I'd be like, okay, I need to stop. I should stop. Why am I doing this? I need to stop. Tomorrow I'll stop. It's okay. Tomorrow I'll stop. I never ate and thought, wow, I'm in the biggest size, the clothing store fits, and what am I going to do next because nothing else fits me? That was never in my mind. It was never the fact that I couldn't walk up a flight of stairs without stopping in the middle because I couldn't breathe. As I was eating, I was never thinking, wow, if I keep eating this, I'll have to sit up sleeping every night, which a lot of nights I had to because I couldn't breathe lying down at that weight. But those thoughts, all I was looking for was an answer to something. And I can't even tell you why I ate. I really can't tell you why. I did. It was what I did. It was what I started when I was this big, and I just got really, really better at it until I was this big. I had lots of excuses to eat. How many of us, you don't have to raise your hand, but how many of us ate because we were happy? How many of us ate because we were sad? Because we were celebrating? Because we were lonely? Because we were worried? The list could go on. How many of us ate because we were awake? No reason needed. I'm a compulsive overeater. I was searching for something. When I first came into the rooms, they talked about a spiritual malady and they talked about character flaws. I didn't think I had any character flaws. It was the rest of the world that did me wrong. I was fine. My problem was food. And then I found out that I suffered from a spiritual malady. And that malady began as way back, as I said, as a little girl. And food was just the symptom. It was my answer. So my life, as long as I can remember, was unmanageable with food. But also, as long as I can remember, my life was unmanageable in general. Outwardly, yes, I functioned, I had a marriage, I had children, I kept a job. But we all know that doesn't mean we're staying peaceful or happy. Inside, I was crazy. And the people around me, they knew I was crazy too. So, what have I covered here? The nature of the disease. I am fully convinced I am a compulsive overeater and food addict, and I will be till the day I die. I consider myself recovered because I went from that description. Let me give you my biggest food story. Just if you need any more convincing about the way I ate. I was dieting, and I had lost a significant amount of weight, and the world thought, wow, you know, you got this licked. They always thought I had it licked every time, and I knew inside, you know, my heart would break because I knew I didn't have it licked. And I got a new job. This was just before coming to program. I got a new job, and of course, what do? When you leave, they get a big sheet cake, okay? So here's the sheet cake, and they're like, Joe, we know you lost all this weight, but you can just have one piece, so of course, I'm dieting, little tiny piece. I had to leave work early to go to a chiropractor, and they insisted I take the rest of the cake with me. No, I'm dieting, I don't want the rest of the cake. Take it. There was a lot of cake left in that box, and a lot of it was pre-cut into pieces, and a lot was still whole. So, all right, I take it, I put it on the seat next to me on a 45-minute drive to the chiropractor. I had no fork, I had no napkins. So what did I do? I ate with my hands. That machine kicked in. Now, I don't know about you, but I lost my full mechanism a long time ago as a binge eater. I went from wanting food, I don't know if it was ever hunger, wanting food to incredibly full and to the point of being sick. And there was really no in between. So I'm eating, and I pull up to the chiropractor, and I look down, and there's icing. There's icing on the steering wheel. There's icing on my clothes. There's crumbs on the floor. You know, the big book says, pounding on the bar. How did we get here? How did I get here? It was like a blank on the way. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to go in and see the chiropractor, and I smell like icing. So the first thing you do, we're good, aren't we? We're good. I say, oh, I got to use your bathroom before I see you. So I run to the bathroom, I clean up the best I can, and then I'm like, how am I going to lay on this table on my belly? I don't know how I'm going to do it. And this man was a good chiropractor. He took like half an hour on my belly. I escaped this. Nobody knew, right? Still incredibly sick. What do you think was the first thing I did when I hit that car? Eat more cake, because the minute it hit the house, my family would see how much there was, and I'm on a diet after all. and then I wouldn't be able to have any more. That is the insanity of my disease. And the Big Book describes it as trying the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results. 47 years. My best dieting got me to that picture. My own best efforts. I consider myself recovered because on page 85 of the Big Book, this is part of the step 10 promises. Oh, by the way, in the beginning I didn't say, I have completed all 12 steps several times. My last time through was an intense line by line study of the Big Book. And I live right now currently in steps 10, 11, and 12. Which means, you'll find out more during the weekend, I do a 10th step during the day, I do an 11th step most nights and in the morning, and part of that is when I'm feeling some kind of way, I do a mini 4th step, which includes 4 through 9. So I live in 10, 11, and 12, but basically I work the heck out of steps 4 through 12 every day. Every day. My life depends upon it. And this miracle is such a blessing. I am willing to hold on to it however I can. So on page 85, it explains what the transformation is. I went from that crazy compulsive overeater to, we will see now that our new attitude towards liquor, food, has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. Now, that does not mean no effort on the steps of the program. No effort towards food. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. Thus, I think, was my craziness my first couple years in program. I thought I was doing it myself. I had to surrender and have the problem removed from me. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. This is how we react so long as we keep in a fit spiritual condition. I can tell you my first few years in program, I was abstinent and I was crazy. I was absolutely crazy. One of the best things that happened to me is I came to my first meeting, abstinent. Somebody invited me to my second meeting, my HOW meeting that I started on a Friday night. They invited me to the Sunday meeting, and at the Sunday meeting, somebody looked at me and said, "You want to start a step study?" And I said, "What's a step study?" And they said, "Sit down." My second meeting, I started working the steps. I consider that another miracle that fell into my lap. And today, food doesn't talk to me. It doesn't call to me. It doesn't dance on the plate. It doesn't speak to me from the cabinets. I have my meal, and I live my life in between my meals. And it's been a while now. That doesn't mean I don't have a stray thought every now and then, but the Big Book tells us what we do then when we have that stray thought. And I do understand now, finally, recoiling as if from a hot flame. For, you know, probably, this will probably come out many times in my weekend. I would rail, that's not fair, I got gypped. You people are telling me you haven't had a food thought in 20 years? And I was still white knuckling for the first couple of years. I'm like, what do you mean? You haven't had a food thought in 20 years? Well, now I finally get it. I go through entire days, weeks, a month without wanting to have any, without wanting any extra. I can work with patience and take cake, a bite with the perfect amount of icing and cake, and feed it to them and be happy that they can have that. That is the joy in their life. And I don't rail at the world anymore, at the universe, that I can't have it. It's okay. That's what I consider recovered. I can watch my friends, my family, my people around me eat, and it's fine. I'm happy for them too. For a couple years in program, I wasn't like that. Boy, I was resentful as hell. I remember the first time my friend at work, let me compare you to some of the people, compare myself to some of the people around me. She is as far as you can get from a compulsive overeater. She'll sit all morning long. I don't know what I want for lunch. And me, new in program, like, what do you mean you don't know what you want for lunch? Like, there are about 8 million options out there. You have a car, you have money, go buy lunch. I don't know what I want. all morning long. Lunch comes and goes. Well, did you ever get lunch? Nah, I couldn't figure out what I wanted. So no, I didn't eat. What? I even would try and talk her into it. Well, have this. Well, have that. Because I couldn't handle the fact that she was not living to eat. She said to me, I was early in Hal, a couple months in, I was on a roll, I was on a pink cloud, I was strong, I was abstinent, I was thinking, this is too easy. Anybody experience that? I'm thinking, wow, this is too easy. The hard part came later. She says to me, you mean you're never going to have sugar again? I said, well, yeah, never, never, never for the rest of your life. You're never going to. And this is my best friend, but she did not know what she was doing. And I felt like a rubber band in my brain was twisting. Like, I'm never going to have it again. But then I had one of those spiritual moments. You know, we'll talk a lot this weekend about spiritual experiences and spiritual awakenings. I had one of those moments that said, no, just for today. Just for today, I'm not going to have it. And I felt my body relax. And I didn't have a relationship with my higher power yet at that time. But I know looking back, that was higher power that said, look, just break it down to a day. Early on, and for a lot of years, well, back and forth in my earlier years of program. Look, I haven't been here that long. I've only been 6 years, but it feels like it was a long time ago. Not eating or following my food plan was one day at a time. That was my focus. That has been removed. Now my eating is just merely a habit and something I do. My one day at a time is my spiritual condition, my connection with my higher power. And that's a good thing because I don't have to struggle with food one day at a time. My one day at a time is what am I doing to keep my conscious contact with my higher power? Because after all, that is, it is my higher power that did this for me. I would like to read to you page 51 in the big book. It's talking, it's in We Agnostics, it's talking about step two, leaving aside the drink question. They tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. And I hope this weekend to show you how that change came over, how I went from there to here. I talk with my hands. This is hard with a microphone. Can you see me? Look, the hands are going to move and then my body's going to go with it. When many of hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. There's the big difference between belief and faith. I walked into that first meeting and I saw people with long-term abstinence, with recovery, and I had that little inkling of belief. Well, okay. My first thought was, I'll give it 2 months. I don't lose weight. I'm out of here. But I saw that little bit of hope, that little bit of belief that said, well, they're saying this works. I didn't get faith until I felt it work for me. And as the description I read earlier, I didn't realize it happened. It's kind of like you look back and you say, wow, all of a sudden I'm handling foods and I could care less and it's in the cabinet and I've forgotten it's there. That is, I can't say enough how much of a miracle that is. How did it happen? Well, I know people qualify they were struck abstinent. I can't say I was struck abstinent. I made a decision, I started a food plan, and I know not everybody needs to follow a HAL program, and I fully respect that. I sponsor both HAL and traditional OA people. I am a black and white person. It's just my nature. It's who I am. And I'm either all in or I'm all out. And once I decided to do it, a structured program just really worked for me. So I got abstinent because I am pretty good at following directions. As much of a miserable mess I have made of my life, I was willing to follow the instructions. But my spiritual awakening, my recovery, it took years. It took years. It took a lot of hard work, a lot of work in the steps, a lot of stops and starts, a lot of times that maybe I... Well, the first time through, it petered out halfway through my step group, and we didn't finish. And then the second time through, I felt it. I felt the promises. They worked. They happened, but I didn't maintain it. I didn't keep working
the specific instructions every day. So I started white knuckling again. I started getting crazy. I started feeling insane. So I'm really, ooh, that's not a good thing to do. Page, in the back of the big book, page 567, in the appendix on spiritual awakening. All right, I got to stop for a second. The spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book. A lot of people work semantics. What's the difference? A spiritual experience, a spiritual... I always kind of use them interchangeably. But somebody lately has taught me that a spiritual experience is when it comes all of a sudden, like Bill had. He said he felt like he had been lifted up on a mountain and the breeze had blown and he found God. Bang. Well, for me, I had more of a spiritual awakening that's described here. Oh, let me go back and read. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. The theme of this, nothing in my life changed, I changed, it's really true. The world didn't change. My family didn't change. I had the same job, I had the same dog, the same kids, the same home. Yet, I woke up. Not in one day. It took a couple of years to wake up and find that it was all beautiful and that the problems were within me. I had a complete personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life. And that is exactly what happened to me. Some examples, it's hard knowing a whole lot of people are coming tomorrow. I don't know what to save and what to say tonight. Some examples, I've had some, if you ask me any day how I am, I'm always, the automatic reaction is always good. How's life going? Oh, it's good. I've had some trials lately, and through all of them, I have not had to eat. I have not even wanted to eat. 2 weeks ago, we hosted a big book step study weekend, and it was fabulous, but I did a lot of work, and I got a little over-anxious, a little over-stressed, and I thought, that's okay, I have 2 weeks to prepare for this. Let me get through that. Remember, I'm an all-or-nothing person, so I threw myself all into that, and then I have 2 weeks to prepare for this. And last Thursday, my father-in-law became critically ill. We went to his house, put him in an ambulance, and started round-the-clock shifts at the hospital. My kid's over, my grandson over. I don't have to tell you how surreal life gets. The house is full of people. They all eat differently. I fall into the caregiver role. My job is to make sure everybody's eating, make sure everybody's drinking, everybody's, you know, taking care of themselves somewhat. So I'm cooking food and buying food. As a matter of fact, this is how my program works today. We put him in the ambulance. I was the first one there, and then my husband and son came up afterwards. My husband went in the ambulance. So here's my son and I. I'm like, well, what do we do now? It's 6 o'clock. I said, well, let's get the house straightened up. We had to do some things from around the house. He said, then we go home and I get my dinner, period. There was not even a thought. And he knows after 6 years, that's what we're doing before we go anywhere else. I can whip together an abstinent dinner in 10 minutes flat, eat it, move on. It was not even an option, not even a thought. And I had a very nice conversation with somebody this week. That is my sacred pact. That is my higher power's will for me. For somebody who has not been through the steps and doesn't have that conscious contact of every day finding out what your higher power will is, my higher power wants me to eat the right food at the right time so I can be of help to other people. If I don't do that, I am no good to anybody. And that's what this book does. It doesn't teach us the steps so that we can be happy. It doesn't teach us the steps so, you know, we can be fulfilled. It teaches us how to be of use to God and to our fellows. How to serve God and others. Ironically, brought me an awful lot of happiness. But happiness was not the main goal. So it went through all through the weekend. Wherever I went, I made sure I had the right food I needed, more by instinct at this point, more by habit, which is an awfully good habit to have. And I constantly thank you, higher power, for this miracle. I can deal with stress, I can deal with family, I can deal with my 4-year-old grandson, the light of my life, and feed him his little snacky foods, and it was not a problem. It doesn't get any better than that. It doesn't get any better than that. And you know, the big book says, they tell these stories in this book because, page XII, at the end of the foreword to the first edition, it's talking about the changes in the big book, the stories in the back. It says, if you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me. Or most important, yes, I felt like that. Or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. I really think this program is there for anybody. Anybody who's willing to trudge that road and put in the work. And I'm not going to lie and say it isn't a lot of work. It's a lot of work. But boy, is it so worth it. It is so worth it. Let me see how I'm doing on time, because I can go on forever. Okay, I'm still good. Another example. I had to ask my husband's permission, because it's his story, not mine to tell, and he was more than willing that I share this with you. My current husband, we're going on 29 years of marriage. It'll be 29 years in January. We know each other pretty well. He is not a food addict either, or a compulsive overeater, but his substance is nicotine. And he's given me permission to share this. And he will probably be listening to the audio afterwards, so love you, honey. You're handsome, you're wonderful, you're awesome. But there were times in our marriage that I threatened to divorce him if he quit again. Look, at that point, I'm like, just smoke and get cancer. I can't live with you when you are restless, irritable, and discontent without his substance. And he quit over and over and over and over again. And every time he went back to it, really, you know, I had to offer an amends for that, because he lived with me through all my crazy dieting, but I didn't see that I was the exact same way. Now, I work this program, and he watches me, and he knows what I do, and he's incredibly supportive. Yet, when his father went in the hospital, he picked up cigarettes. And I have the utmost empathy for him. He does not work a 12-step program. He doesn't have a higher power that can do it for him. It's humanly impossible for him. His own human strength is not enough to keep him from his addictive substance. You know, that doesn't mean I enable it, but I certainly don't want him. He was hiding it from me. I'm like, come on, honey. It's okay. And then, you know, I see the correlation. You know, the different addictions are so much the same. You know, okay, so he's bumming smokes off his sons, and he thinks I don't know. And then I tell him, look, I know. Well, it doesn't matter, because tomorrow, that's it. It's done. How many times did we say that? And he got up, whoop, not having one. And it took till about noon, and he was bumming another one. Now he's in the, well, I'm not buying a pack. I'm not buying a pack. But he's still smoking. And all I can say is, you know, I hope that someday he finds this kind of program that can do it for him. What it does for me is it reminds me of the nature of my disease. My mind, if I give it enough space and block my higher power out, will take me back to it the way it's taking him back. So I think we'll start just to talk about this unmanageability exercise. I only touched on it. You might understand a little more of where I'm coming from further into the weekend, that food was only the symptom. The problems in my life were spiritual malady. The big book describes it as lack of power. I had no power. I wanted the world to be a certain way. I wanted people to act a certain way, yet I was the martyr, I was the doormat, I was the person full of ego that hated myself, which is just as much ego as loving yourself, as hating yourself. They're polar opposites. And I love the bedevilments on page 52. These are all the places in my world that I had lack of power, and nothing was ever good enough for me. I was taught to take, and I hope I'm not infringing on anything by doing this, but to take those sentences in the bedevilments on page 52 and turn each one into a question. And this is what's on your handout. So let me open up to the page. The paragraph. Yes, sure, hand them out. I'll read the paragraph as it stands. And the paper you have changes these sentences into questions. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. In other words, we're not changing our human problems. We're changing our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of usefulness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. So, what I was taught to do as a part of step two was to turn them into questions. But this exercise works as step two, it works in abstinence, it works as one of my daily barometers. What am I trying to manage on my own? And what am I depending upon higher power for? So each of these is turned into a question. Do I have trouble with personal relationships? Can I control my emotions? Now we're talking about on our own power, on our own steam, 100% by ourselves. Am I vulnerable to misery and depression? Can I make a living satisfying enough to keep me happy and abstinent? Do I have a feeling of uselessness? Am I full of fear? Am I unhappy? Do I seem unable to be of real help to others? And then the directions at the bottom of the page review each of these questions 5 different ways. Can I, on my own power, manage to control this? If nothing changes and I stay in the problem, could I still eat over this? Even if this was just the way I wanted it to be, could I still eat? So obviously we're taking some issue in your life, some problem in your life. Therefore, can I see these problems manifest from inside of myself rather than from outside? Can I see these are the manifestations of my unmanageability, untreated addiction, and my spiritual malady? And then the final question is a basic solution for these problems of lack of power important for me, and how important is it? I go back to the fact that some people coming into program and finding recovery, their whole life does change. Maybe it had to change. And people do, you know, find out, get out of an abusive relationship, whatever. I say my life didn't change because I had the same husband, I had the same marriage, yet I was miserable, unhappy, and all of these things applied to me. You know, my husband stuck with me, but I don't know why. I really don't. I mean, bless his heart, because I was not good at personal relationships. I have always been an overly emotional person, always. Am I vulnerable to misery and depression? So anyway, that's the way the exercise works. So I'm going to set the timer and let everybody do some own personal writing and reflection. What this basically is, I don't know where everybody is in the steps. This is basically a step two problem. And, all right, this answers this question. Step one, I am absolutely powerless over food. And basically a lot of other things in my life are unmanageable. I know I can't do it. So that's step one. It's an understanding, a realization. Step two is the hope that there's something else can do it for us, because basically I'm screwed. So our only option is to find a power that can do it for us. So what we're doing is we're breaking it down to what in my life is unmanageable and is a solution for this lack of power. In other words, am I willing to search for the power that's going to do it for me? Because I can't do it myself. And how important is it? How much would it affect my life?
You can do this, if this writing exercise is for you. A lot of this is, if you try and do every one, it might be overwhelming. Maybe you could, when reading that, did one jump out at you that says, you know, maybe I need to write about that? I personally think more than a yes or no would be really helpful. Do I have trouble with personal relationships? Well, I could sit here and do a fourth step, tenth step, any moment on personal relationships. So maybe a little bit of writing. And if it's too much to take everyone, take one question, write on it, and then look at the bottom five and relate it to one at a time so you don't get overwhelmed.